And welcome to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. We're going to be talking today a little bit about technologies and energy directly. But I want to talk a little bit about some of the things in the news this morning that made our papers, at least, and probably are showing up in AP stories around the country. And it's the housing boom collapse, which I thought was an interesting story. Today it made our front page papers. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm here speaking to you from Alaska, and we run a very different kind of economy here. Our economy is driven by oil, and as a consequence, as many of the states' housing markets are collapsing, Alaska's percentage change from last year, we're up 48.6%, which is the largest increase. The next state up is Arkansas at 17.9 and Texas at 11.3 with increases in housing starts. On the other end of the spectrum, Arizona and Florida are both down by 26-27% in housing, followed by California and Virginia. Those are huge housing markets that are declining, and a lot of that decline, according to that article, is based on rising interest rates and, more importantly, consumer confidence. People just feeling a little bit reluctant to enter the market. A lot of that is because of the rising in interest rates and uncertainty about what's going to happen in housing prices. And, you know, I was, interestingly enough, in a long conversation this weekend with one of the members of one of the larger banking families here in my part of the world, in fact, one of the bigger banks. And we were talking about long-term strategy on real estate and housing. And, you know, the long-term outlook is probably pretty good. You know, I mean, commodity prices, which are driving housing costs to a great extent, are increasing dramatically and are expected to continue. So his kind of view was, you know, quarter by quarter, yeah, there's going to be some real upsets. Even year by year, there'll be some real upsets and swings in the market. But over the long term, just because of the raw costs of labor and construction materials, that, you know, the replacement cost of housing was going to continue to rise. And I think he's probably dead on right on that. In fact, in talking about energy and energy policy and sort of how that all evolves, you know, what drives energy consumption is really modern technology and the attributes of it. If you go back and you look at the first visit to China, as an example, when Richard Nixon was first there, and we had a lot of photographs coming out of China, very, very few automobiles. The same in Russia, very few automobiles. You know, mostly public transportation, or quite frankly, in China, bicycles. Not using a lot of raw materials. But today, if you look at modern images of China and Russia, you see a tremendous increase in automobiles, construction. I mean, every aspect of consumption in terms of on a grand scale. The difference is we're dealing with emerging markets with billions of potential consumers. Now, you think about them, consumers buying, living on a few dollars a day and not spending a lot of money on commodities. Well, that's true today. But you see the shift and the change as these countries develop and begin to consume larger and larger amounts of commodities. And we've seen it now, and the effect on energy prices is driven, you know, not just by speculation, but by real demand, demand that's been on the increase dramatically over the last several years. When you look at that demand and you start to look at the commodity prices, whether it be steel or whether it be cement, the basic building blocks of industry, all of those commodities are rising. I mean, copper alone has tripled and quadrupled in price in the last few years. Steel is up. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about what's pushing inflation, what's pushing the price of energy, and what we can expect perhaps in the coming months. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN Live. And we're here every Wednesday, 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. We've been talking this morning, opening up, talking a little bit about housing costs, because that's making the news around the country today. But what's sort of driving that cost? And we start talking a little bit about commodities prices. You know, when you think about these emerging economies, What we read officially in the newspapers is 11 to 13% growth in China. Think about that for a moment. 11 to 13% growth, that's the official number. Unofficially, it's as high as over 20%. If you think about the population, you know, the population there is five times perhaps what the U.S. population is. You know, what does that really mean when you think about five times as many people in an economy growing 13 to 20% a year? When you look at India, another huge, huge population with economy increases in consumption and production in that same range. When you start to think about growth of a billion or a couple of billion people's economy at 11 to 20% versus 300 million people in the United States, you start to get a sense of what that growth really means. But as it demands commodities, for instance, just shipping, getting the stuff from point A to point B, airplanes, look at the airplane orders, you'll see them up all over the world because people are having trouble getting the freight to its destination. The other issue is the big bulk commodities like oil. You know, there's a shortage right now, actually, of oil tankers. More difficult to arrange tankers. You know, 10 years ago, you'd get a half a dozen tankers to haul your oil and have your pick. Today, you're lucky to find one to haul your oil, which is a big problem. Refineries in the United States haven't had a new refinery in over 30 years. Probably takes 10 years just to get through the lawsuits and litigation to get one built. Third world, they're developing refineries, but it takes years to construct. So, again, even if we could create the infrastructure, we couldn't solve the problem. Here in Alaska, many have heard and most have heard by now that our pipelines are running at a significantly reduced capacity. You know, where we've lost 8% of domestic production because of British Petroleum's failure to maintain and properly inspect their pipelines up here. You know, whistleblowers reported this problem over 2 years ago, and they were ignored. And then this winter we had a spill, and now we have a shutdown at a most critical time when we don't need it, and a foreign corporation trying to straighten out the mess. You know, many don't remember what happened here a few years back. You know, Atlantic Richfield was selling off its assets up here. British Petroleum was about to buy them. That would have made them a total monopoly on the North Slope, and their maintenance practices would have been extended to the other side of the field, which, quite frankly, is the side that's still producing. The fact is, British Petroleum was blocked from that acquisition, and it was blocked by an antitrust suit that I filed along with one of our constitutional signers here in Alaska, a guy named Vic Fisher, a prominent Democrat. I was a member of the Alaska Independence Party, and then the Republican moderate chairman joined us in that suit. And we filed the first antitrust suit years ago that blocked that acquisition. Later, California, Washington, and Oregon filed a suit. We withdrew ours. They settled theirs, and BP was prevented from monopolizing the largest oil field in North America, Prudhoe Bay. And ConocoPhillips came in, and they ended up taking a piece of it. At that time, I was advocating that the state of Alaska ought to acquire the asset. And the reason that I felt the state of Alaska should acquire ARCO's holdings in Alaska is because, number one, we had the money in the bank. Alaska has $30 billion in what's called our permanent fund. It's been derived by putting 25% of all of our royalties that we've earned on minerals and oil and gas into this fund over the years, and we had plenty of money to buy it. It sold for actually $8 billion. What that would have done is given the citizens of Alaska 52% of all of the natural gas on the North Slope, 33% of all the oil on the North Slope, and 22% of the oil pipeline. Now, why was that important? Well, number one, we've had some serious problems on developmental strategies. The oil companies take this globalistic view of the world. Alaskans take a national view and a state's view of the resource and try to bring it to market in a reasonable way to meet national requirements, not to maximize necessarily profits, although the state, you know, receives royalties from leasing these holdings to energy companies here in Alaska. The reason and what would have happened had we done that, I mean, look at oil prices. This was 5 or 6 years ago. Had we done it here in Alaska, the citizens of Alaska, we pay no state income taxes. We pay no state property taxes. We don't pay a state sales tax here. We pay virtually no state taxes in Alaska because we generate our revenues from the royalties derived from the public resources coming out of the ground that we lease to industry. Had we acquired ARCO, Alaska right now would be sitting with $3 or $4 billion in excess funds for our state budget, as well as permanent fund dividends. The state actually pays us each year. This year, we each receive about $1,100 as our share of the earnings made on that permanent fund. In other words, our share of sort of the public wealth. So instead of government being supported by taking from us, government is supported by the resources in its control and actually gives back to its citizens here. Quite a reversal from the rest of the country. Yet, the same kind of thing could have been possible, still can be possible, in many of the raw resource-producing regions of the country as well as the world. We just had a really bright Republican governor way back in the the late 70s began to field this idea of a permanent fund, and it turned into the best thing we could have had happen here. It gives us a super good bond rating, lower amounts of money being paid to debt service or interest, and an absolute advantage here in Alaska. You know, when you think about the housing statistics, here we have a 48% growth in housing over last year, while the rest of the country is experiencing significant declines from last year's numbers, or even have reversed them. You know, the oil industry, and when you think about commodities and you think of where they come from within the United States, you really have to look to the western states, and you look to Alaska, and more particularly because of the vastness of the minerals and energy resources that are held here. This place, when you think about energy as a major impact on our economy, the U.S. consumes about 35% of all the energy in the world. That's changing. I mean, it's shifting more and more as more of the world develops. But the fact of the matter is, for this kind of society and culture, energy is probably one of the primary costs and building blocks at the same time. When you think about energy prices inflating, think, too, about the possibilities that are offered by alternatives, because think about the deficit in the dollar and what's happening with it. Most of that has to do with our balance of trade, and so much of our balance of trade is now dictated by imported energy, whether in the form of oil or any other form for that matter. And when you're importing energy and creating those deficits, you're having a huge impact on dollars. So anything that we do that stops the bleed, I mean, we've got two things happening right now, dollars being exited because of oil and inflated because of the amount of money that has to flow into that sector of the economy. The other area is just general imports, where it's take our dollars out of the country into these developing and emerging areas of the world, whether it be China or India. I mean, it's our demand that fuels their demand that increases our pricing. I mean, it's all the circle of the economics. And when we get to the end of the day, we either have an opportunity to look at what's happening and begin to address those specific areas that are creating the most negative impact on the American public. And if you look at it, it gets back to this policy or lack of policy, comprehensive policy on energy. This is you know, what I consider to be the major issue of the day, because it drives all of it. It's going to affect small farmers. It's going to affect every one of us in terms of inflation. And the very first inflation numbers are just starting to come in that are beginning to reflect all of these changes. The, you know, the whole thing about all of this is all of us at the end of that chain are the victims of it. We don't have a whole lot of say necessarily in how it all evolves. Today, if you want to get into the conversation, I want to give that 800 number. It's 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443 if you want to call in and get in on this conversation. You know, when you think about, again, thinking about energy policy's overall impact on all of us, you know, today in the hour just before me, they were talking about the huge snowstorms and weather effects and the things that happen when the weather really works against you. Well, think about that with energy prices as high as they are, the ability to recover from these kinds of things and even to address them. You know, state budgets, local budgets, city budgets are all being hit hard because energy costs are going up, and that's going to affect, again, every one of us when we can least afford it. A lot of these costs haven't fully rolled up. They haven't been seen in your tax assessments for your local property taxes and school districts because it just flat hasn't caught them, and they've been able to juggle things around until their next budget cycles. Well, those are happening now. We also have an election cycle that's dampening a lot of this discussion. You know, a lot of politicians would rather not talk about the fact that they haven't done anything for America's energy consumers or created any hope for an alternative or rational development that'll take us out of the dilemma we're in. And I think those are the questions that we need to ask. Here in Alaska, we have the most contested governor's primary taking place on the 22nd of this month. And this primary involves three candidates, and the big issue is oil and gas. Right now, we have a legislature just coming out of special session trying to revamp the entire taxing structure for the oil industry here in Alaska. And the taxing structure is going to have a major impact on their development and what happens here in national energy policy. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. Call in right after the break at 800-313-9443. 800-313-9443. And you're listening to RBN Live. Welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're talking about energy again today and energy policy. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about some of the impacts of all of this and how it all affects us. You know, when you think about, again, energy policies, you know, there was an early attempt almost now 6 years ago where the first Bush Jr.'s administration was addressing energy policy. Remember, Dick Cheney came out of Halliburton with a $20 million parting bonus as he ran for vice president. Many forget that. You know, I always consider that the biggest contribution any politician ever received. Anyway, they had their big summit of experts in energy, you know, way back, and met in the White House, had several meetings, never released their full data. In fact, the Congress demanded it. They've avoided it all these years, and yet, boy, look, whatever policy they hatched in that room 6 years ago certainly has resulted in some unusual circumstances for the rest of us that aren't so promising. At the same time, everyone associated with the multinationals and big oil, including this administration's entire family, has made their fortune in oil and gas and are even making more today. You know, the sad story is the rest of us are looking at the impact of this policy, and it's not such a great celebration. It might be for some of those on Wall Street, but it really worked against Main Street. And I think that's what many people forget is, you know, they look at these energy companies and don't recognize. We need to recognize that the energy resources, at least west of the Mississippi, are publicly held. In other words, they're owned by you and me. You know, these oil and gas resources under the ground are leased to these multinational companies. And in exchange for those leases, we receive rents and royalties. You know, here in Alaska, as I said before the break, our session legislature was in session discussing, because we run a gross tax. In other words, yeah, it was real simple. You know, the oil came through the pipeline, figured out how many barrels it was, multiply that by the dollars per barrel, and multiply that by 12.5%, and that was our royalty. Very simple calculation, nothing complicated about that. You need a meter, you need the oil price, and you need a calculator. Because the number's usually too big to figure out in your head. The point of the matter is, today they're going to a net profit tax. Now, anybody who's been in business understands the difference between the gross and the net in terms of what you can do with it. You know, there's a lot of things, a lot of expenses that get charged off. And for multinational companies, a lot of those expenses that should be charged off, somebody else's oil field likely be charged off here. That change in oil policy at a time when the price of oil is so high was really a wrong direction. What they should have done is just benchmark the gross, you know, increase the gross tax as the price of oil goes up so that there's some a way to capture some of that revenue, but then to redirect that revenue to try and solve the long-term problem, which is energy dependence, something that multinationals don't have an interest in solving, but national governments and certainly every citizen of this country has a real interest in solving because of the impact on commodities, the impact on production, the impact on inflation. Getting some solutions in this area could fuel new industries, but at the same time begin to head a much different direction. But we have to think longer than Wall Street thinks, which is quarter to quarter, three-month increments. I mean, what can you get done? You can't even build a highway in 3 months, much less solve any other major problems. So looking at all of this, we have to take a longer view. We have to take and really demand of our politicians policy development that creates the right incentives for individuals like you and me to find our own ways of energy independence, whether it's putting in better, more efficient appliances like we used to be able to do in the 70s and get those incentives that make technology and applying technology practical for people. Those types of things are not being developed right now, and energy policy is for sure lacking. When you think about farmers this year and the harvest season is coming up, you know, the notes are going to be due, you know, and unless the inflation hits hard enough on food prices, unfortunately, a lot of our small farmers are going to be out in the cold this winter in a very rough way. And I think that's one of the things that's being missed is, again, the loss of small farmers and the impact this is all going to have on them. Energy is, in fact, that big component that all of us rely on. It's also the major component for trade deficits in terms of dollars right now. One of the major components is energy. The other is, again, emerging third world, which, you know, it's all, again, a big cycle. As we fuel the third world, it demands more goods. As we get more goods produced, commodity prices rise, inflation hits. Because all these dollars are exporting out, I mean, our biggest export is dollars and jobs, and as a consequence, our dollar will continue to decline over the long run. And this is something that is not being felt at the moment as strongly as it will be felt after these elections, these midterm elections. It'll just determine the control and fate of the Congress. And quite frankly, we'll redirect or continue the path that we're on. Two more years is a long time without getting a little bit of change and moderation, especially in this area, because this area affects every one of us. And the major parties have always done this game, and they're doing it again this year. Get us all fighting over the social issues, and those of us that have a conservative view of those issues have a hard time, you know, avoiding the bait. But think about the bigger issues this election year. Don't sacrifice or compromise those social issues, but let's get some people that know the nuts and bolts of government. This is Changing the Way We See the World, and you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich on RBN Live, and we'll be right back after this break. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we are here every Wednesday, 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And today's topic is, again, energy policy. I want to go back and cover a few things, and then I'm going to go ahead and take callers. Again, the call-in number is 800-313-9443. I want to go back to this discussion of British Petroleum and what's happening here in Alaska, because this really drives a lot of what goes on nationally in terms of energy policy. We have an election. Our governor, who was a U.S. senator for three terms, he was a guy that actually my dad ran against. The last time my dad ran and was alive for an election was 1970, and he beat Frank Murkowski, and my dad went on to join the 92nd Congress back then. Murkowski became a U.S. senator after that. State of U.S. senator won the governor's race 4 years ago, and then appointed his daughter U.S. senator to fill his vacancy in the United States Senate. He then is now considered, I think, the second lowest rated governor in the country, next to somebody who's been indicted out there in lower 48 states. But the point is, he's running in a contested race. The big issue is oil. You have him on one side representing big oil and putting together this latest scheme of the oil industry and being their proponent for that in our legislature. The next guy, Binkley from Fairbanks, long-term old Alaskan family, maybe a little bit more balanced in terms of his interest in Alaska. And the last person in the Republican primary, the more interesting candidate, is a woman, Sarah Palin. This is in the Republican primary here in Alaska. And Sarah Palin actually resigned from a $130,000 state oil and gas commissioner job over corruption by party officials involved in the administration. One of them was fined for ethics violations and had to resign. And yet that individual who had to resign the Oil and Gas Commission post under this governor is now the chairman, or not the chairman, excuse me, the executive director of the Republican Party here in Alaska, and remains so. So the issue is over ethics, interestingly enough, and oil, interestingly enough, in Alaska. This primary is going to be decided on the basics of ethics, and the polls are showing Sarah Palin, this dark horse, as the candidate to win, has her in front by almost 11 points a week before the primary election. Pretty amazing and pretty impressive, considering she's been outspent about 3 or 4 to 1. If that's an indication of what's important to people, that energy policy does matter, that more importantly, ethics matter as we apply energy policy and as it affects every one of us, here it affects us dramatically. And because we have an energy policy that reaps a benefit to this state, we have a 48% housing increase while the rest of the country, 28 states in the rest of the country, are now declining. That's pretty amazing. And it's driven because of a different view of policy. The other thing is population. Alaska's a pretty small place in terms of population. Most of the large cities where this broadcast is picked up have populations larger than our state. We have 700,000 people here, very small population. The other area I want to go back to is this permanent fund, because I think it's a point that people have missed. It's something that really was a pretty good innovation. What they did is they took 25% of all oil and gas revenues that the state received and put it in the bank, basically. And then with a non-politically appointed board that has maintained this fund since 80, it's experienced 10, 11% growth rates by investing conservatively in the stock market, real estate markets, and other investments that big funds make. And then what they do is they take the interest, the earnings on that fund over a five-year average, take half of that value, and once a year, average that out per year and pay out a dividend to the population. And it comes out, I think the highest it went was a little over $2,000, and this year it's expected to be about $1,100. It's not the price of oil that dictates this dividend, it's the price of the investments that are made. But when you think about it, the state has in the bank about 10 years of its operating budget in cash, liquid assets. That's an amazing thing in this day and age. If you look at resource allocations historically in the United States, you'll find that often the industries have really taken advantage of public resources. In the case of the old railroad barons of the 1800s, they got 1 mile wide right-of-ways along the railroads to build a little ribbon of rail. The reason they got the mile was then they controlled all of the offloading and loading of freight, so they could charge exorbitant fees for handling the freight, for handling produce, for handling goods, and the real money was made in the transportation, not by the small farmer who was impoverished because of it, or the consumer on the other end who paid higher prices because of it. That same mindset of the big company versus the little guy exists today. And the fact is it's taken advantage of us on oil policy in a way that nobody, that makes the railroad barons pale by comparison. I mean, oil companies are now as big as many governments from around the world. We're taking callers again today at 800-313-9443. And I've got Jeff hanging in Massachusetts. Jeff, are you still hanging in there with me?
Oh, yes, and yes, I want to talk about energy policy. Did you know that Nikola Tesla invented a machine that would pull energy out of the air, and they completely killed it? And you see, Edison wound up becoming a hero, and Nikola Tesla wound up getting the shaft.
You know, that's a great point you raised, because Tesla, for those that don't remember, Tesla invented the entire generation and distribution system for AC current, which runs all of our homes and most of our businesses today. AC current was the challenger for Edison's DC current, because he wanted, of course, that transmission system. And the fight ended at Niagara Falls during the World's Fair of 1900, where literally they lit it up. And when they lit up the World's Fair in 1900, it determined which way it would go at Niagara Falls. In fact, there's a statue that you can see of Nikola Tesla, one of the very few, at Niagara Falls, which is a big AC generating system. And the reason it won out is AC would travel much further and much faster. But Tesla didn't stop there. And you're right, Jeff. He developed a technique for doing it wirelessly, and actually there's a number of papers that he presented in the early 1900s and late 1800s describing that whole system. And it was originally financed by, I'm trying to remember, Morgan, I believe, was the banker. Morgan Bank in New York financed him. And then when they recognized it, they'd gotten so far that his intention was to essentially make the energy virtually free. I mean, he felt that he could produce energy out of the vacuum, out of space, you know. And there's actually a NASA project that was declassified a couple of years ago in this same area. But Tesla was 100 years ahead of his time. And this is what I'm talking about when I talk about alternatives. Beyond what we know as far as hydroelectric and geothermal and solar, Tesla had ideas that someday, sooner or later, someone else is going to develop. And the belief is, by many researchers, that that knowledge is already held, and it's only a matter of time before we see it affect the marketplace. And it will totally change everything. Tesla's technology was way ahead of its time.
Well, let me add to this, and I got a couple of good points to add to this. When the world becomes a dictatorship ruled by one ruler, then all this technology will come out and be released because the world will be under a dictatorship. And also, too, in the Bearden book called America at the Brink of Oblivion, I mean, Bearden has a good insight about all these people that invent these forms of technology. They either get killed, get put in jail, they get framed, they get assassinated, they get microwaved. I mean, as I was reading this, my jaw hit the floor. And the communist countries have the scalar wave technology. Our country is still using the old model, while Russia and other countries are using the new model, which is Tesla technology.
Yeah, you know, this is I would agree with you on a lot of those points. You know, the fact is, this technology has been around a long time. It would not surprise me at all. You know, again, it's like when you look at Tesla's work, and I have every one of his patents, I have all of the published papers he ever wrote, and all of the lectures transcribed that he ever gave that were transcribed. And when you read the whole of his material, you get a real appreciation for, first of all, his genius, and secondly, about the solutions. I mean, these solutions need to be pursued vigorously today. We need a national prize for the guy that comes up with these ideas, because you're right, other countries are developing and have developed these technologies. Those countries that don't have high energy resources are going to be the countries that announce these technologies and then take on the industries that come from them. And it's an opportunity. I mean, all of these concepts originated with early inventors. I mean, the Edisons of the world approached it one way. The Teslas were quite different in their approach, but brilliant. And in the end of the day, the industrialists of the early 1900s didn't want free energy. That worked against their self-interest.
Exactly.
And that's, again, why corporate interests cannot dictate national policy, because their interests aren't about what's good for you and me. It's about what's good for their bottom lines. And, you know, and don't get me wrong on this. You know, I believe capitalism is the answer in terms of economic systems, but we need to make sure that capitalism represents values as well, not just dollars and cents values, but the kind of values that allow a capitalistic system to exist. And that means liberty, freedom, and a representative government that really represents the interests of people. And we lose that when corporations take over. We lose the opportunity. And when you say technologies will be suppressed, you're absolutely right. They have been. And I want to remind listeners that, you know, a lot of our work is now being sponsored in terms of our research side by the Lay Institute on Technologies, and you can see info on that site at layinstitute.org. And when you go there, take a look at the goals of the Institute, because they're all about technologies and the use of technologies. And we hope that the Institute, as time goes on, we're set up to support the work of inventors and educators in these areas, opportunities to help bring some of these technologies perhaps forward where others get in the way. And our hope is that the Institute will serve a larger and larger role. We've got a very important meeting in Dallas coming up this coming week. And once that meeting is over, we're going to have a lot to announce to our BN listeners about the initiatives that we'll be taking that maybe will take on some of these issues in terms of technology and solutions on a very, very practical level.
This is a very good and deep conversation, because I believe what's going to happen is, especially in America, we're going to have a fascist-style system to where only government-appointed people can invent stuff, and people who are not government-appointed will get sent to camps. And it'll be a very fascist, Nazi-style system. All you have to do is look at the Nazi scientists. They use human beings for experimentation of drugs and other sickening experiments. And we're going to have that in this country, too, by the way. And people are not awake. And what they want to do is keep the people dumb, happy, and stupid while the elite has all this wonderful technology at their fingertips.
Yes,
on the green.
You raised a good point. Is, you know, the Nazi scientists that were, you know, really enslaved in work camps. Some not so. Some were, you know, pretty enthusiastic to work for those causes. But after the war, and this is important, you know what happened to all those Nazi scientists? They either went to the Soviet Union, or 700 of them were brought to the United States by the predecessor of our Central Intelligence Agency. And they brought them over under a project called Project Paperclip. In fact,
right.
Project Paperclip brought over one guy, a guy named Hermann Schwann, who later was one of the key individuals in setting electromagnetic field safety standards in the United States, which were 1,000 times less stringent than the former Soviet Union. And these are scientists that were involved in human experimentation, not necessarily Hermann Schwann, but others. And as a result, you know, we took advantage of that research, and then we went on from World War II to today. Back when Secretary of Energy O'Leary was in the Department of Energy, she announced during the Clinton administration that over 500,000 Americans have been victims of human experimentation over that 40-year period between the end of World War II and the Clinton administration. And I can tell you, those are the same players that were doing the same work in those Nazi camps, and here they are in the U.S., with American scientists and others engaging in the same kind of abuse, and yet no one was ever held accountable for that. You know, technology, all of these technologies have a huge, huge impact on what happens in the future. And again, you know, institutions need to be established, organizations need to be created that will address it from a point of view of you and me, the average guy. And Dorothy Lay from Dallas has set up an institute to at least help us be able to attack that, and maybe invigorate a number of other scientists around the world to take their science and maybe apply it differently. And we've had some conversations with a number of scientists that I've met over the years, some of them quite distinct in their fields, to come around some of these issues and really look for solutions without government or industry getting in the way. And
exactly.
That we're excited about.
Exactly. And another good point, too, and this has to do with energy, flying saucers. Now, myself, personally, from the research I've done, I think that flying saucers are nothing but top government secret projects out there, and they use the UFO nonsense to fool the people. That's what I think.
Jeff, there's actually, in a number of military documents we found that are instructions to subcontractors, they're to use that story as their, part of their cover story when using experimental aircraft. The other issue, the type of craft that have been spotted, you know, many now we understand were our own. In fact, most of the things we spotted were our own. But there is still a percentage that are sort of in that unidentified group, and, you know, those remain to be figured out. But in terms of the kind of anti-gravity effects, T. Townsend Brown was a U.S. scientist. T. Townsend Brown did work in anti-gravity, worked in government labs most of his career. I have actually about 8 inches of his lab notes that somebody gave me.
Wow.
And they're pretty impressive. You know, when you look at the work that's been done in this area, there is quite a bit of work. I think that's, again, where we're going to see some huge, huge changes in technology, and they're going to come in our lifetime. They're going to really revolutionize everything, and who and how they're introduced will make a huge difference. I mean, if they're introduced in a free market environment and not constrained, those technologies will literally change every one of our lives in a very positive way. On the other hand, if they're controlled and contained, then we're denied the benefit of that creative outpouring. And I think that's a mistake. Somebody else will then create it, and it won't be the U.S. that benefits from it.
To interject, I believe these technologies will be introduced when the world is under global fascism, and these will be like tools in a toolbox to keep the people oppressed, and enslaved, and that's it. That's what I believe is going to happen. Technologies do come out, my friend.
Jeff, thanks for calling in. We've got another caller holding, and you know, the lot is going to change. We're coming up on the break. We'll be right back in a few minutes. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And I have Elizabeth in Michigan hanging in there for me. Elizabeth, are you still there? Are you there, Elizabeth?
Yes, I am, Dr. Begich. It's an honor to be able to talk to you, sir.
Well, thanks.
I wanted to mention there was a caller to the George Norrie show, which I normally don't listen to because it's so late at night. But I was anticipating or excited about something that was going to occur the next day, and I couldn't sleep. So this caller made the statement to Mr. Norrie that he has a friend who has gotten a patent out on a device that's half the size of a refrigerator. It just uses water to operate it.
Yeah.
It has air coming into the unit. It will provide power to the entire house. At a cost of very minimal cost.
Right.
Because it uses the tap water, actually.
Yeah.
He also indicated that Home Depot has placed an order for 1 million units from this man. And there's also a smaller unit. The home unit will cost $4,000 to $5,000. The smaller unit will cost $1,900, according to this man.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be out in 3 weeks, or Home Depot will get their units in 3 weeks. Now, he said it's a secret. And Mr. Norrie asked him to send him an email.
Right.
He would like the man's name. Well, frankly, I don't think the man should release any information.
Right. You know, there's a technology, you're talking about water. Most likely what they're trying to do is split hydrogen, although you know, it could be something totally different. But there was a technology reported in MIT's journal. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology has a journal called Technology Review, and it released just a couple issues back a new invention by General Electric that actually will produce hydrogen out of water at a cost a little bit less, actually, than the current price of gasoline. In other words, it's finally, even for big companies like General Electric that are well-known and in a journal like MIT's, they're saying that technology is now economical. In other words, it can be produced. If you can get hydrogen, you can just change the orifices on a person's furnace, and you can burn hydrogen. You might have to change the carburation a little bit, but you can burn hydrogen if you can create it at home. And there was actually a guy named Puharich back in the 1960s that figured out some ways to do that by stimulating water molecules to break the hydrogen and oxygen, which make up water, and to split them out to be so you could use the oxygen in one direction and the hydrogen to fuel things in the other. This is exactly the kind of technology that we need right now. If indeed Home Depot is going to have 1 million units, that's pretty exciting stuff. And I think we'll wait on that and see whether it comes to be. But I absolutely know the technology exists today to solve these kinds of problems.
Yes.
Elizabeth, hang in. We got the music coming up right after the break. Why don't you stick with me and we'll continue this conversation. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're heard here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. I always forget to do this. I want to give out my website for those that are interested in finding out more about our books and publications. And we've got a lot of information there. It is EarthPulse, EarthPulse.com. Earth Pulse is my company. It's where we produce our books and publications and DVDs. So again, earthpulse.com. For research material that we use in this program and in our work, look at the layinstitute.org, layinstitute.org, for that information. Today's subjects spend primarily dealing with energy issues and a little bit on climate, a little bit on housing, but these things tie together. We actually have a video, a DVD, that covers earth changes and energy issues. It's called Earth Changes, and you can find that at earthpulse.com. Elizabeth, are you still sticking in there with me?
Yes, I am, Dr. Baggett. Wouldn't miss it for the world.
Well, thanks. You know, I appreciate the questions, you know, and you sound like someone that, you know, is concerned about what's going on with energy. And if I can say, you sound like an elder, so you're probably on a fixed income where
yes,
that's going to have
yes,
a big impact on you.
Yes.
Is there anything going on in the state of Michigan to try and help people deal with this issue, or is everyone just kind of hanging out like they are at the national level?
That's what's happening here.
Yeah.
We're having government's getting a little too strong in Michigan right now, and people are not aware as they should be.
Yeah.
I gave my grandson your first book many years ago. He's in his 20s now, and let's see. He must have been about 16, 17. And I want the kids. The kids are the important thing in this. They have to have the knowledge.
Yeah.
And he listens to me. He's getting very understanding at this point in his life.
Well, you know, that's the 20s when kids hit their 20s. I have 5 children. My oldest is 28, and my youngest is 13. And I can tell you, that is where the challenge lies. I think the next generation have been really hampered in so many ways. And perhaps there's still a remnant left, and I think there is, that's intelligent and intact. And it doesn't take a lot of people, you know. It only takes a few people to start to take an interest in issues to bring them to the rest of the public, and things can change. And
right.
Those are the young people that really need to be matched up with the seniors in our communities. Because, you know, the young people have the energy, the seniors have the experience. When those two come together, nothing can stop what
right.
results. And I think that's right. what we've missed.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much separation, not enough recognition. And I think parents and grandparents particularly used to play a big role, you know, things that parents couldn't say to their kids, grandparents often could.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a difference. Kids respect elders. Our culture may not, but kids do. We need to take advantage of that and start teaching these next generation of children, not just the information. They get plenty of that in school. They need the values.
There's a lot of social engineering that's gone on with these youngsters, and they're not aware of it.
That's exactly right. And parents have been impacted by just flat not having the time. You know, parents are working 2 and 3 jobs now. Grandparents that are in a position to spend more time with younger children should do it. I mean, it's an opportunity. Kids love the stories. The stories teach the lessons, and the lessons are about the values that make and have made our country strong. You know, my dad always taught me that. You know, my grandfather spoke very, very poor English, and yet he was not an educated man, but you know what? He had a lot of wisdom, and it's not about formal education. It's about what's under it. Elizabeth,
right.
thank you for the call, and we're going to a break.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to RBN Live. This is Dr. Nick Begich, and we're changing the way we see the world. And you can call in at 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN Live. I'm here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And we've been talking about energy issues predominantly today and kind of hitting on a couple of other subjects. The last caller, Elizabeth, was talking about young people being the real target, that we really have to try and enlighten and educate young people, not so much overwhelm them with information, but really instill the kind of values that make them interpret information against a proper foundation. And I think that's what's been missing. You know, I worked here in Alaska For 6 years, I worked as a tribal administrator and village planner for one of the indigenous federally recognized tribes here in Alaska. And I learned a lot, I mean a tremendous amount, about the culture and about how people really operate on a much different basis than we do in with most of our Western thinking. But what I found the most powerful thing within the culture that I discovered was this connection that was recognized and valued of bringing elders together with young people as a major component of the educational process. In fact, the primary component of the educational process. When you look back historically at education in Europe, it used to be the grandparents that delivered most of the education, and because they were recognized as holding the keepers of the wisdom. Today, because information is expanding so rapidly, we've kind of lost that, where elders kind of get lost in the technical shuffle. But it's the wisdom, the values, those important features that really are the things that are missing for young people, a setting of the ethical standards. So when they develop and work in these technical areas, they apply those lessons learned. This is where the combination can really happen and where a great deal can be done. And it's ignored in our culture, where it ought to be encouraged, because that's where the long-term solutions are, especially when you start to think about how busy parents are and what a greater role grandparents could play in the raising of children. You know, when you think about, again, sort of where this next generation goes, I mean, I'm not a pessimist by any means. I think there are some great, great opportunities. It's a matter of refocusing our values, creating institutions of accountability, and making sure that what we want within a democratic republic is pushed into national policy, because government springs from the people. It doesn't come down on the people. At least it shouldn't. And I think that was the recognition that our founding fathers had, you know, 200 years ago. Over 200 years ago, they sat around and thought about this concept and said, you know what? Government's constituted by the free will of men, and the free will of men determined the outcomes. And what we have today is the free will of a few manipulating the outcomes for the many. And energy policy is affecting every one of us in every possible way, negatively right now, because of a lack of leadership, a total lack of leadership in an area that is solution-oriented, and instead a requirement to enslave us to greater dependence on energy sources we don't control. This is what's breaking the back of our economy, and it's breaking the back of the American character. It's forcing people to work longer and harder for less and less, buying less and less, getting lost in that trap where there's very little time left. You know, in the 60s, we were all being told that, hey, we're going to face the leisure society, a society that's going to be so independent, we're going to have 30-hour work weeks, we're going to have all this time to engage in civic areas and engage in areas that improve the condition of human beings. And we haven't seen anything close to that. All of that dividend of our technology, all of the dividend that's been derived from our productive efforts has been handed off to multinational corporations, all at our expense in the long run and the short run. And now, after careers in industries, people working hard, we have our government telling us, oh, by the way, the pensions you all thought that were going to be there, whether it be Social Security or whether it be your retirement from your corporation, we can't handle it. You're on your own. That's the wrong answer. In this time, at this point in our history, when we should be the strongest, we should not be the weakest to our own people. That's where the problem lies. $1 trillion spent on defense on foreign soil could have been spent developing the best alternative energy system in the world, keeping us off of foreign soil where oil is the issue of the day. National security is energy policy, but national security and energy policy don't start and end at the doorstep of Iraq and the Middle East. They're right here at our own border. We have the opportunities, the technologies, the innovation. We just don't have the leadership in the area that this country really demands and deserves. Today's conversation, if you want to get in on it, it's 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443, and we're talking about energy and energy-related policy here in the United States. You know, the same policies are perpetrated not just here, but all around the world. You know, whether you're listening in Europe or Asia, these policy decisions, and if you look at your own governments, the policy decisions that they make really have this roll-up impact. You know, in Europe, they've been paying excessive prices for fuel because the government taxes the heck out of it with the idea of restraining or constraining consumption. And it works. The fact is, though, a more comprehensive approach, the type of initiative that demands a change really requires a very different view of the politics. You know, the fact is, one of the callers earlier, Jeff, was talking about suppressed invention. And, you know, I think that ought to be a criminal event. When a company deliberately suppresses an invention to maintain a market advantage and deny the public these kinds of solutions, that's criminal, you know? I mean, maybe not in the purest sense of the law, but it ought to be a situation where if they don't want to develop a technology, then it ought to be removed from them and given to the public, and then derive a royalty, a payment, where that inventor still receives a payment in consideration for their inventiveness, but they can't hold up the process beyond a reasonable period of time because the public needs these solutions. Intellectual property rights need to be protected. You know, I know what those rights are about when you publish a book or you do a video or you invent something. But if you're suppressing it, if you're holding it back, at what point is the public entitled to that invention? And the fact is somebody else could come up with the same invention, modify it slightly, and then it's out there on the market anyway. And that's the condition that we're in right now, because all of these technologies now are being looked at. When you start to see MIT reporting on hydrogen cells that can be economically viable today in the average big city in the United States, that means those cells are already in every remote part of the world where transportation is a factor, economically viable. You know, here in Alaska, we pay $6 and $7 a gallon for diesel fuel once you get off the road system because it all has to be flown in. Systems that could generate energy at the local level could be twice as inefficient as what most economies could stand, and yet in the developing world, including the developing world of Alaska, this could actually come into play and be quite useful. The fact is it's equal to gasoline already. By General Electric's design, hydrogen is now possible to be out there competing with gasoline, and the reality is it's only going to get better. I mean, whatever's out there right now is only going to get better. The cost per unit of energy produced is going to decrease as these technologies advance, but we need to make sure the capital is attracted and has the right incentives. Right now, those incentives go to an oil industry that's gouging the heck out of us and making record profits. You know, that same industry here in Alaska, 17 years ago, we had an oil spill. Everyone remembers of Exxon Valdez. And there was a $5 billion judgment because it wiped out the fishing industry down there, and a lot of people lost their boats, lost their livelihoods. You know, it's our version of agriculture in Alaska. It's in the sea. And, you know, that judgment has still not been paid. 17 years later, they made more than that in one quarter, and they haven't paid the damage they've done here. And they haven't solved the problem. And it's the same companies that are dominating the oil industry around the world and yet not really heading into the solution venue. You know, you see some of the oil companies now investing in alternatives, and the reason they are is because they can see the handwriting on the wall. They don't want to lose a market share in energy. Ultimately, they want to maximize what they can out of their existing assets, and they're doing a pretty nice job of it right now with plus $70 a barrel oil. You know, in the mid-80s, it was $8. It had hit $8 a barrel and stabilized around 20. It's almost 400% increase in the raw cost of the commodity and only predicted decline based on constraints, again, in refining and transportation. Doesn't matter whether we can produce enough. You know, the Alaskan oil pipeline is designed to handle 2 million barrels a day. And before the BP shut down the half the field, we were only running 875,000 barrels a day. And it's not for lack of oil. It's just that there's no real incentive, and there's a limit on what people can refine, and there's a limit of what people can haul because you required now double-hull tankers in Alaska, and there's just not enough of them. Double-hulled so that if they hit something, they're less likely to create the disastrous kind of spills that we've seen in the past. But again, it's being constrained. They're talking about building a gas pipeline from Alaska down to the lower 48 states because our gas, for 35 years, our gas has been reinjected into Prudhoe Bay instead of moved to markets. We could have built a pipeline and the facilities to handle the gas under the existing corridor without any need for additional right-of-ways or minimal permitting and actually constructed a gas line and had the gas liquefaction plants and tankers already online to address the shortages that we're into right now. And we knew all this years ago. Now they want to build a pipeline financed with guarantees from the federal treasury, which I don't know why an oil industry needs any guarantees with the kind of money they're making these days, but we're going to underwrite the risk, which is a huge risk. They're estimating it to be a $20 billion project. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline was estimated to be $500 million and turned into $9 billion. If this one follows the same rules, it'll be 18 times more money by the time we're done, and we'll all be paying for it. And it's 10 years out before it's finished. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and I want to talk about that Canadian gas line when we come back right after this break. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're heard here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Time. And we've been talking about energy and energy-related issues today. Just before the break, I was talking about the Canadian gas line. And this is another big controversy, not making much news elsewhere. They're talking about putting a gas line in from Alaska to the Midwest through Canada. The alternative route is through Alaska on the existing corridor, and there's a big debate here in the state because to build it through the existing corridor would take about a third as much time. In other words, probably 3 years out versus maybe as many as 10 years out to get it through Canada, as well as the price. You know, the cost of the commodities is going to continue to inflate. We've been talking about that. They're attaching federal guarantees onto this pipeline that are going to obligate the American public to pay any cost overruns potentially on this line. And it's unnecessary, number one. If the companies want to build it, let them undertake the risk. They have the money. Don't ask the American public to take on anything else for the oil industry. We're already doing it on the gallon-by-gallon installment plan. You know, every one of us is paying the price already. The fact is, this debate has to do with a couple of things. First of all, to defer the risk. They want to shift the risk to the public as opposed to them. When they built the Alaska pipeline, it was a cost-plus job, which meant that every dollar you spent, you were guaranteed a 10% profit margin. So the more you spent, the more you made. The incentive was to spend and waste as much as you could. And the deal for the oil companies is it has to do with the setting of the transportation tariff, which comes off the top before they have to pay any rents or royalties or anything else to the public in terms of those resources. So it's a way for them to, one, jack up the price, and then we're eating the cost. And then number two, all the subcontractors always make a fortune on these deals, which they did. One of the biggest ones was Brown and Root. Does that name sound familiar? On the Alaska pipeline when it happened. I mean, it made some of the biggest construction companies in the world. At the time, it was the biggest construction, privately funded construction project ever undertaken. Amos broke the backs of the oil industry, but they came out, and of course they always do, come out on top. Now we have a bigger problem, and the inflation on commodities prices, the underwriting of these risks for the public are not the kind of risks, and they're done in a fragmented way. They're not part of a national energy policy. They're not part of anything but a special interest lobbying effort by the oil industry to get the public to pay their bills. And it's wrong-headed and is going to result in, number one, here we are going through another country with our gas, and the Canadians, and rightfully so from their perspective, will want to transport some of their gas out of their northern gas field. So it won't even be necessarily U.S. gas running that complete line. A big percentage of it will be Canadian gas that fuels our trade deficits in the wrong direction. So it defeats, in one sense, the purposes. For Alaskans, bringing it to the coastal areas and seeing the gas liquefaction plants and facilities that are needed built alongside of it, it's all doable. They can all be constructed during the same time as construction on a pipeline and at the end deliver gas, natural gas, to the lower 48 states at a time when we need it, not 10 years from now, but perhaps as little as 3 or 4 years from now. That's a big difference and one that we need relief in right away. Again, you know, when you look at Alaska, we're so far removed from the mainstream that people miss the impact of what happens here. Yet what does happen here affects everyone. You know, our senior senator from Alaska, people hear about all the time, Ted Stevens, you know, he's the champion of pork. But, you know, as long as the Congress is focused on these issues, we really got to ask, where is the policy that develops not just solutions for Alaska, but solutions for the rest of the country? And we're missing that. We're missing that cleanly woven fabric and replaced it with a patchwork quilt of special interest politics. Mark's waiting in Texas to get in on this conversation. Mark, are you still with me?
Yeah, hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Very interesting. It looks like, you know, they're continuing with their plans on the various scenarios to shut the nation down. And I think I heard just recently on the news that how even they're blaming Hurricane Katrina for a lot of the problems with getting oil back online in the Gulf of Mexico. Do you see this as another a symptom of the type of judgments that are coming down upon this nation? We see terrorism in Deuteronomy 32 and Psalm 91 against a rebellious nation, and we also see the prophecies of foreign wars.
Right.
But it just looks like, I mean, even in Revelation it talks about don't hurt the oil. So it seems like we've got this crisis developing that's following right along with everything we read in the scriptures.
You know, I agree with you. And you know, I was at a conference back in the late 90s, and I just delivered a lecture. And a woman approached me after the lecture. She came up and she introduced herself. She said, "I'm Maria Beckett, and what you've just delivered is the apocalypse." And then she said, "I'm with the Orthodox Church, and we trace our roots to the island of Patmos and the revelation of John." You know, well,
wow.
that stops you in your tracks.
Wow.
And I thought about what she said, and I thought about what I just delivered. And the fact of the matter is, all of these things have been predicted. And, you know, prediction is about warning. And right after the break, I want to talk about what that warning means. Hang on, Mark, and
okay.
We'll be right back.
Yeah,
you're listening.
Thank you.
All right, hang in with me. We're listening to Changing the Way We See the World, and you're listening to RBN Live, and this is Dr. Nick Begich. Hang in with me. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're here every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Right before the break, Mark's still hanging in with me, but I want to respond to what he was saying is, you know, this idea of a prophecy and what's happening is being fulfilled. You know, prophecy is about warning, or it's not about condemnation, and it's not to inject fear, but to do the opposite. You know, and it's not necessarily has to happen today. You know, prophecy is about warning, letting us know there's still opportunities to change a direction and forestall. You know, I mean, God doesn't condemn, but actually gives us a chance to relook at what we're doing. You know, and you know, the idea that these things generate a lot of fear, I think we need to remember that where fear comes from. And, you know, though the verse that comes to me is, though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we shall fear no evil. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for that. It reminds me of the story of three guys in a furnace getting roasted, only to find out they weren't roasted. And there's a fourth guy in there with them. The fact is, we're not alone. We are meant to be creative, to do things that others dream of because of who we are and what our birthright is. And we need to recognize fear is not part of that, just the opposite is. And having said that, I want to go back, and Mark, I know you had something else you wanted to add into this conversation. Mark, are you still with me?
Mark, can you hear me?
Yeah, you betcha.
Okay, great. I perfectly agree with that, and I see, too, how the ancient prophets, of course, it wasn't in condemnation. They were sent to try to save.
Yeah,
who they were sent to speak to. We even see Nineveh acknowledging their sins,
right,
and the wrath being turned away. We see in Hosea 4:6 where it says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." So the prophets come to give you correct knowledge, and so that your worldview, as the title of your program is, so that their worldview can be altered onto the righteous and narrow path. And if you agree with that statement, I wanted to share that a lot of the problems that Christians and Americans and the psychosis that we're inflicted by is as we were warned in Deuteronomy 4:2, which says, do not add to and do not change the words that I've spoken. And this is what we find out with a lot of the New Testament English translations, is that things have been added and changed into those scriptures, in effect, by the Satan, the devil himself, who, you know, you don't have to destroy the Bibles to deceive the world. All you do, just as he did in the Garden of Eden, is you twist the words around a little bit and you cause a misunderstanding of what the Creator has told you. And one of these examples, besides the word Easter in Acts 12:4, which is the name of a Babylonian fertility goddess,
right,
which the Christians call upon every springtime, this is the blasphemy. And the problem is that we've been taught to blaspheme. And Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 8 tells us that the false pen of the scribes would write the scriptures wrong. And so we see this throughout the scriptures. We see these contradictions. We see this ritualistic cannibalism blood-drinking ceremony called communion, which when you research it, you find out that the words eat and drink were added by the Gnostics of the mystery schools.
Yeah.
And there's this website, and they have a book. It's called Communion, the Bloodfest of Babylon. And in Revelation 17:4, we see that the whore of Babylon is drunk on the blood of the saints. So we have this blood-drinking false religious system, and this is a result of these mistranslations. The ancient cannibalism ceremony to ancient Mithra, these sun gods, who were cannibalistic. And it's a great book. It's at www.remnantofyhwh.com. And they exposed a lot of these falsehoods in hopes that just like ancient Nineveh, the people would heed the warning and stop being deceived by these mistranslations.
Yeah, you know, I think this is, you know, there's many, many people within the organized churches that are sincere and are seeking the answers. And there's a lot of people in the mainstream churches that have warmed the bench and quit looking, and yet they still have this breach in their faith and breach in their confidence. And what I say to people is, don't stop looking for the truth until you know that you know that you know. Because anything short of that is deception. Self-deception is the worst of all because it denies you your opportunity to really find that truth. And I think everyone looks in a different way, and we get really wrapped up in condemning everyone's path. And I think we need to recognize that, you know, God orders the footsteps of man. And the fact of the matter is, all paths can lead to the same finish line if we don't give up on our search for the truth. And that's the key element, is not to quit looking. And I think we forget that. When we think back, and I said it last show, last week, you know, when you look at the story of Solomon, it's a guy that looked in every place that your parents would not want you to be looking. And yet, at the end of the day, he recognized it all as fallacy, and he was standing right in the middle of his own truth, which is a recognition of one God. And, you know, the reality of all of this has to do with looking for answers. And whether you're looking in science, religion, politics, or business, if you're seeking truth, you'll find circumstances that lead you to it. And I think that's the challenge of the day. Don't give up on the underlying values.
You're right. We see deception on every level. And even Solomon, in all his wisdom, in 1 Kings chapter 11, it says he turned away from the Creator Yahweh after the pagan gods of his polygamous wives that he had. You know, he had over 400 wives, which was also condemned in Deuteronomy 17:17. So even in the wisdom that we feel that we have, if we're not being obedient to the plan of the Creator who owns this planet, you know, this is his planet. We're just visitors and caretakers of it. And and like I said, you know, most people have wondered, how the heck could this Messiah of Israel have instituted this cannibalism ritual? But you find out that the words eat and drink were added.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of Christians would like this information, because if there's any hope of saving this nation, it's because this nation repents and turns back from all these abominations. And I just, you know, like I said, this book is outstanding because it shows the proof that nobody else has provided about the Gnostic forgeries.
Right. Right.
And it's at this website, www.remnantofyhwh.com. I just, you know, it's just an eye-opener, and that's what people need. They need to be changed so that their world can be changed by these revelations since 9/11.
Absolutely. Mark, I really appreciate the call, and I think you're right on target. Is, you know, the issue is really changing. You know, we can get a lot of information, but it's organizing that information with wisdom and understanding. That comes from what links us to the Creator. That is from the Creator. We need to apply that into our lives. We need to begin to recognize that fear is not the answer. It's the answer is in the hope and in the possibilities that each of us offer one another. through that creative birthright that we have. And I think that's what we've forgotten in many cases. You know, we're so fearful and afraid, even afraid of the end, and yet the end is only the opening for the next door. You know, we're at a short stop between interviews here, 70 years or more maybe on the planet. That's a big trade-off for eternity. What we do here does matter, but what is more important than the result is the effort. We have to make efforts to change the way our world operates, even in those areas that are around us. This doesn't mean that we have to jump way ahead of ourselves to things that we can't accomplish. We need to look at what's right in front of us that we can do, whether it's talking to our grandchildren, whether it's talking to our neighbor, whether it's interacting with a politician, whether it's doing something more than that based upon the skills and talents and abilities and time and calling that we each have. And we need to begin to express ourselves in the ways that we can, making the effort, not winning or losing every time, but trying every time and learning from our mistakes and continuing that effort with the faith and confidence that we can each make a difference, and we can. I'm talking to people from Alaska. I've been in this work for 12 years all over the world talking about technologies, and I've seen things change. I've seen things happen that give me hope every day that we can make a difference. And that's why we continue in this effort, and we want to be an encouragement that there is a better way. There are opportunities to make change. We have a birthright. We need to claim it and press it into the world when it needs it now. I've got Marilyn hanging in California. Marilyn, are you still with me?
I certainly echo your last caller's, as a Christian, his belief system. When I look at the events, I tend to look at the events of what's happening via the weather and via what the oil companies are doing, and it seems
right.
Like they're really lowering the boom lately. I was down in L.A. when I first saw this BP article about BP shutting down a pipeline, and that triggered a thought in my mind that there's something funny going on. Does that make any sense to you, that there would actually be corrosion, or are they trying to further limit the supply of oil down here?
I think it's the timing is almost, in my opinion, extortion, because we're arguing the big tax issues up here. So to shut it down puts us all in a little weaker position at the bargaining table. The other issue is, there were whistleblowers in Alaska that 2 years ago began complaining about this issue way before the spill this winter and way before this latest shutdown, and BP had neglected proper maintenance, or they would have discovered these problems long ago. I mean, they were immediately discovered when they put what are called pigs, and they're these devices that have lots of instrumentation. They run them down the pipeline to do a couple things, to clean, but also to detect erosion and corrosion on the inside of the pipeline. You got a lot of friction. You got chemical reactions, and they weren't doing it. And yet the whistleblowers had told there needs to be institutions. One of the things we had pushed for years ago in Europe, and we continue to push for, is whistleblower institutions that deal with not just government but private sector for exactly this kind of problem. Here are the national interests at stake from a British Petroleum, a foreign national corporation that could care less because the price of oil is just going higher. They're writing off all these expenses. They're not losing a dime. They're making more money because of it. And whether they're rebuilding the infrastructure fast enough in the Gulf after Katrina, or whether they're correcting this problem fast enough, or whether they should have even had these problems in the first place, or the bigger questions that aren't going to be answered or asked by this administration, which is beholden to the industry. We've got to change our perspective on this industry. They are not our partners. They are our tenants when they operate within the United States, and they are not our national corporations. They are multinational corporations, and their interest needs to be contained when they operate within this country.
Well, I find it interesting that and I hold a lot of oil stock, that I get these stockholder magazines once a year, like Exxon is the lamp, Chevron. They're all buying into the Agenda 21 Sustainable Development, which shows you how on board they are with the globalists. Schemes. Everything's sustainable, everything's vibrant, you know, the keywords they use, and it really scares me, because it really shows me they are definitely on board to start limiting the amount of the assets they hold to the general public, and that, of course, goes along with the Agenda 21 scheme to downsize everybody's standard of living to third world class. And,
right.
You know, how do you fight this kind of thing? You've got the behemoth of world government with firepower beyond anything we can imagine, including such things as scalar weaponry. How do you fight this? Only with information, it seems like, but even if a person's informed like I am and you are and you're getting it out, how do you do anything about it?
Well, and I think that's where the greater possibilities are starting to form up. You know, I mean, we've been at it a long time, and we're finally starting to attract not just the assistance and the technical help, but at a level where we really see the possibilities of making some impact. And, you know, not just being able to provide information, but actually working with inventors and researchers to assist them in bringing their science forward in a way that really does improve at least some of the things that we're seeing around us. And then that, of course, will fuel other efforts. And we have some resources behind that. And we've got some things coming up in Dallas this next week, and hopefully those meetings will go as we expect. And, you know, the next initiatives will be launched. And the fact is we believe we can still make a difference. And there's plenty of people out there that believe the same way, and that doesn't require a majority of the population, which is where people kind of get defeated before they stop.
Right.
You know, and they get into the game and they go, wait a minute, you know, how am I going to ever convince? And you don't ever have to do that. I mean, and the American Revolution started, they say, with 6% of the people thinking it was a good idea. Everything that has ever been good that has come out of any change in the way we look at the world hasn't come and sprung out of the status quo. It's come out of the edge of things, and where one or two people get together and say, you know, I see it a little bit differently, and then begin to project that. And we're seeing that. I mean, the name of this program, Changing the Way We See the World, I believe that's where you start. You change, you got to change your view and quit feeling defeated and beat up. We all go through that. I go through that. Everybody does. But the reality is we have a greater hope. The fact is we've got all this capacity that's underutilized. We just need a little more leadership, a little more emphasis with the public, and we need to recognize leadership isn't some guy at the top of the heap. The leadership is every one of us. That's the way it works. We just have the thing upside down, and we forgot over the last couple hundred years, gradually forgot that the leadership of the country is the population, and the politicians represent our leadership, not the other way around. And they forgot it, so now they come at us. Instead of lifting us up, we need to change it around again by demanding that those segments of our population that need to be lifted up are lifted up in a fair and rational way, and those that do need to be pressed down are pressed down in the appropriate way that cultures and our society demands. And
I would caution that lifting up those segments that need to be lifted up would not be through more government taxation
and
regulation. That has proved a complete failure.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Ruined whole. I mean, you look at the African American and other minority groups that were doing quite fine, thank you, before World War II, some of them, as well as the Caucasians or any of the other, and they are now, because of government handouts, their whole family structure has been.
Sure.
So we don't need government subsidies, that's for sure.
No, we need a different approach to the solutions. I mean, we need to make sure people have the skills, that they have the job opportunities. The education system needs major revision. It's a 100-year-old model. It doesn't work anymore. It gives you a lot of information.
I noticed the new word is educator. Change it from educator/brainwashing back to teacher.
That's right.
You know, help you think instead of give you the company/government, big government line.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's a process of thinking. There's too much information already. You know, the basics that we need, we're all values-driven. If I think back on my elementary education, so much of it was values-centered, you know, about what was right, what was wrong, what was important, what wasn't. And more importantly, was the kind of thing that said, made you think, made you have the debate, made you make your arguments, made you justify them, things that were real debate. And today we find that what kids are taught is to absorb and accept rather than challenge and question. And challenging and questioning for young people, when it's done in the right way, is the most exciting kind of learning. It's the old style of learning. If you go back to the first teaching of the Greeks, it was in conversation and questions and answers and inquiry. You know, there's a lot to be said for this, the institutions of learning. And when you look at the alternatives that have developed in the private sector, the success rates from homeschooling to private schooling, it's phenomenal because there's competition in the marketplace, something that doesn't exist once again, because of government dominance on education, and now at the national level with a national agenda, that's wrong. Education is a local issue, should always remain a local issue, and when dollars are put towards it, they ought to be available for parents to decide where the best education for their kids are. You're listening.
Thanks, Doctor.
Hey, thanks, Marilyn. I always appreciate it. You're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. We're going to come right back after the break. I'm going to talk a little bit more about education because of my experience there, so hang in. We'll be right back. And you're listening to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live. We're here every Wednesday from 11 to 1 p.m. Pass the word. Let others know that we're on the air. And talking, I know that someone called during the break and needed that website that Mark gave out. I don't have that, but if Mark is listening, Mark from Texas, why don't you email me that information? You can email me at earthpulse.com. Send me a note, and I'll get that on there for the next program. The other thing I wanted to mention is we were talking about education and that really being the backbone. You know, I was twice elected as President of the Alaska Federation of Teachers and Anchorage Council of Education. I'm the only statewide ex-teachers union president that believes in vouchers that I know of in the country. And the reason I do is I think that all of the problems that people have pointed to with vouchers can be overcome. And working in the institutions, not in the classroom but in the administration, I know, in fact, that it is the case. The other issue is dealing with quality and character of education. I think parents need to decide, not the state, what is best for our children. The resources that are spent by governments, local and state, quite frankly, are inefficiently managed, poorly handled in most cases. Small school districts may be a little bit different where people are a little closer to the action. But I can tell you nationally, the model is flawed. We need much more flexibility. We need a lot more variety of educational opportunities that really provide kids the opportunity to gain the kinds of skills that will equip them for not only making the decisions that all of us, as we all get older, will be living with, but has the same kind of values that we do. So we make sure that the kind of future generations actually progress rather than move in opposite directions. Education is the key. Real teachers, teaching is a gift. That gift needs to be amplified in ways that really change the way things work. And education is always the first step. The teaching process is important to that. But more importantly is the action on the other end. I mean, we can talk about all these issues, but what we really want to encourage is the kind of creative solutions that might actually introduce some of the new technologies in a much different way. And hopefully in the next few weeks and in the coming months, we'll be able to bring in some of those working on some of these concepts. There are several scientists out there that I've been in communication with recently that are doing some pretty amazing work. And we're going to talk about some of that. Some of it's in the new energy field. Some of it's in life sciences. And, you know, in all of these areas have an impact, and we're going to try and get some of those folks introduced over the coming weeks. You can check us out at earthpulse.com or theleyinstitute.org. And again, we're here every Wednesday from 11 to 1 on technology-related issues. If there's issues you're interested in, give us a call. You can call us toll-free at 888-690-1277. Again, 888-690-1277, and that's for Earth Pulse. You know, going back to the callers of the day, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, sort of how energy policy plays into the events around us and how those might even line up many of the prophecies that were given, you know, thousands of years ago. The reality is these things do repeat themselves. You know, the opportunity for disaster or solution is always there. You know, it seems like we're on the march to Armageddon these days, but that march doesn't have to be these days. We need to listen, look for the solutions, and again, tune in next week for Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich.